America, particularly under George Bush, has become an extremely aggressive force in the world, a bully. I wouldn't describe myself as anti-American in any way at all, but I would describe myself as anti-American exceptionalism. America's a beacon of freedom in the world. America spreads democracy and liberty around the world. And as such, America's entitled to certain rights, that it has special rights in the world about how it behaves. It's entitled to all the rights every other nation's entitled to, and not one single right more. Why would we want to lend the credibility that we have as a nation to justify, to in any way facilitating this aggressive behavior?
That's Canadian author and Toronto Star columnist Linda McQuaig. She's kicked the sacred hippo and skewered Conrad Black's journalist wife and examined the cult of impotence. More recently, McQuaig hunted down the global oil industry in her book, It's the Crude, Dude. She earned the title of Canada's Michael Moore, but in fact, as you will discover in today's speech, she's her very own Canadian truth teller, Linda McQuaig. Today, we're proud to broadcast Linda's latest speech about her new book, Holding the Bully's Coat, Canada and the U.S. Empire. The speech was recorded May 8, 2007, by Thomas Hicks of the Necessary Voices Society. It has also been broadcast by the Red Eye Collective on CFRO Vancouver. McQuaig examines how the so-called new government of Canada, elected by a minority of the people, has moved the former peace-loving nation firmly into the camp of George W. Bush, the war on terror and militarism. This is CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver, and you are listening to The Brown Bagger Show, Tuesday edition. From the Maritime Labor Center in Vancouver, here is Linda McQuaig.
It's a great pleasure to be here at the Maritime Labor Center. I must say I've never been here before, but this is a wonderful place, a great feeling to the room. And I must say it's a great pleasure to speak to a group like this that I just have a feeling is concerned about notions like the public good. From time to time, I'm invited to speak to audiences that aren't concerned about the public good, like, for instance, business audiences. In fact, I'm not even sure they understand what the public good is, except maybe that it's something that they could try and privatize. I'll just tell you quickly, in fact, about one experience I had where I was invited to speak to a business group. And I was a little surprised because it was a very sort of elite group that met in this sort of swanky club in downtown Toronto, and I don't normally get invited to places like that. But I you know, accepted the invitation, and I showed up at the event. It was a little bit different than the Maritime Labor Center. I got there, in fact, and everybody was all these, it was all men, and they were all dressed up in black tie. But the place was packed, and I thought, you know, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe business is interested in hearing what I have to say, you know, hearing me tell them how they should pay more tax and all that sort of thing. But I must say it turned out a little bit differently than I expected. In fact, it was all downhill that night following the introduction. The introduction was quite different than the nice, very kind introduction Amanda just gave me. The introduction that night, the guy introducing me began with an apology. He said, "Gentlemen, I'm very sorry to tell you we have with us here tonight Linda McQuaig, who's here due to the cancellation of our real speaker, the man you all came to hear, Conrad Black." Anyway, times, of course, have changed. One good thing I will say about Conrad Black is that he may soon be in jail. But anyway, I am very delighted to be here tonight, and I'm delighted to have an opportunity to tell you about my new book, Holding the Bully's Coat. I think the title probably gives you a flavor of what the book is about. And let me just say, I do think titles are very important. I learned that with a book that I wrote a few years ago called The Cult of Impotence. I wasn't aware that there were so many people that would buy a book expecting solutions to something other than democratic impotence. Of course, when you write a book with a title like that, you have all kinds of problems. People, particularly men, don't really want to be associated with you, I notice. I mean, the guy I was going out with at the time that I was writing it, well, actually, he thought the title was kind of cute, but he wanted me to promise him that under no circumstances would I dedicate the book to him. Anyway, so what I want to talk about tonight is the notion of Canada holding the bully's coat. And the bully, of course, is the Bush administration and America, the way it's operating in the world. And I don't think that's even particularly controversial among Canadians that the U.S. is operating as a bully. I think maybe what they're less familiar with is the concept that Canada has been acting as a kind of helpmate to the bully. I think there's a sense in mainstream Canada that we kind of sat out the Iraq War and that that was a really smart thing to do. And that as such we've kind of missed out on, or we've avoided the worst excesses of U.S. lawlessness in the world. But in fact, we are deeply involved in Afghanistan, and Afghanistan is in many ways very similar to the war in Iraq. And all this, I would argue, is part of a broader transformation as Canada has gone from being a country that's essentially kind of internationally been focused on peacekeeping, on internationalism, on promoting the United Nations, to a nation that's much more military in its focus, and essentially operating as a kind of junior partner in the war on terror. And you know, this is part of a very significant changes about how we've been relating to the world. Just to mention a few other areas that I also deal with, I mean, there's the whole issue of the Middle East. Traditionally, we've at least attempted to play a kind of conciliator role in the Middle East to be somewhat balanced in our approach. Certainly, you know, I go over the history, certainly we've always had a bias, if anything, in the direction of Israel, but there's been always an attempt, at least an understanding, that we should try and facilitate communications and do our best to bring about some kind of solution to that Middle East problem between the Palestinians and the Israelis. But recently, first of all, starting under the Martin government, but much more pronouncedly under the Stephen Harper government, we've taken a really hardline anti-Palestinian position and a very strong pro-Israeli position. In fact, you know, as we saw in the war in Lebanon last year with the Israeli invasion of Lebanon, I mean, the Harper government took an absolutely firm pro-Israeli position, very much in line with the Bush administration's position, and even refused to join, you know, to support international calls for a ceasefire, even though there were some 40, 50,000 Canadians trapped in Lebanon directly vulnerable to Israeli airstrikes. You know, really creating the situation where Stephen Harper was actually, in a sense, encouraging a foreign army that was directly imperiling the lives of Canadians. I mean, this strikes me as almost treacherous when you think about it, that he was operating more really as almost a prime minister of Israel than a prime minister of Canada. In another key area, in the area of global warming, we've taken some very serious turn. You know, it's interesting that Canada was actually a country that was one of the leading nations in terms of alerting the world to the problems of global warming. We played a really significant role in the early days, back in the mid to late 80s, when we first got a sense of how serious the global warming problem was. Canada hosted an international conference in Toronto, and actually Prime Minister Brian Mulroney, the Conservative Prime Minister at the time, actually gave the keynote address opening the conference, alerting, essentially sounding the alarm about how serious the global warming problem is. Now, clearly, since those early days, we've gone way off track, again, starting with the Martin government, actually starting with the Chrétien government. Although we signed on to Kyoto, we absolutely failed to take the steps needed to get on track to make the reductions. But then under the Harper government, we've even backed away from the commitment to even participate in Kyoto, creating a situation where we're almost at this point, in terms of the global warming dilemma on the international stage, we are almost operating as a kind of international pariah. I want to focus, though, particularly on our role in the war on terror, because I think this is a particularly insidious thing. I mean, we saw in the last few weeks in Parliament just how really compromised we've become as a nation, that we're actually complicit in torture. I mean, I don't need to emphasize enough, that torture is a kind of the depths of moral depravity and not something any civilized nation wants any part of, not to mention the fact that any nation that's a signatory to the Geneva Conventions, as we are, cannot be complicit in handing over detainees to torture, as we were. Of course, we've now done a little correction on that. But, you know, since 2005, again, first under the Martin government, but, you know, continuing under the Stephen Harper government, we had a deal, an arrangement with Afghanistan where we were handing over prisoners, knowing full well, because the Afghan Independent Human Rights Commission was clarifying this, that those prisoners would, in all probability, be tortured. And I think what's striking about all this is how much this bears the hallmark of the Bush administration's approach to torture. The Bush administration, of course, has been very casual and kind of encouraging in torture, as we've seen in their very casual attitude towards Abu Ghraib and their permitting of torture in Guantanamo Bay. And, of course, they have the extraordinary rendition program under which our own Mayor Arar was tortured. And what defines that, is similar to the Afghan detainee arrangement that we had, was that in both situations, we knowingly handed over detainees to a third party that was known to be brutal and was known to practice torture. And that this was distinctly different than, you know, what the European nations in NATO managed to work out with the Afghan government, so that we were following very closely the U.S. model as opposed to the Geneva Conventions model, shall we say. Now, I would argue all of this has absolutely huge implications for Canada as a country. And I'm going to go beyond that. I'm going to argue, and this may sound, like overstating things, but I don't think so. I'm going to argue that Canada's transformation like this actually has significant implications for the world. And, it's fashionable these days to kind of dismiss the idea that, you know, Canada has any kind of significance in the world. We're seen as a kind of washed up power. At least that's the way the commentators in this country are always presenting us. In fact, there's really very little truth in that. In fact, Canada has a great deal of credibility in the world. Some of it deserved and some of it undeserved. But the tragic thing is that we are lending that credibility to the Bush administration by our high-profile support for their war on terror. In fact, I would argue that once Tony Blair retires as Prime Minister of Britain, as of course he's expected to do very shortly, Stephen Harper will be the leading political figure in the world who actively supports the Bush administration. In other words, our own Stephen Harper will move into the position of being kind of chief poodle, if you will. This is a very significant thing in the sense that, by doing this, you know, we are kind of enabling, we are helping enable a regime that's lost all support at home. I mean, Bush is down to something like 28% of the polls with his own people, not to mention the low level of support, that, to put it mildly, that he has throughout the world. And yet here we are lending our credibility to help this regime enjoy some degree of legitimacy in the world. And don't think that that's unimportant. You know, Harper has played a very significant role within NATO. I mean, not only have we, of course, sent our troops to the very front lines in the battle, the U.S. war that is being waged in Afghanistan, but Harper has played a key role within NATO, kind of castigating the other NATO members for not playing a strong enough role. In other words, he's kind of done the dirty work for Bush. You know, he's the sort of heavy that goes around, you know, criticizing the other NATO allies for not being sufficiently supportive of Bush. This is a very helpful role for Bush to have Canada play. Now, if you talk like this, if you talk about how the U.S. is behaving in a lawless fashion in the world, as I think is obvious, you get pretty knocked down here in Canada. You're pretty quickly dismissed as an anti-American. I mean, there's a whole set of high-profile commentators, neoconservative commentators in our media. We're all familiar with them, you know, Andrew Coyne, Margaret Wente, Robert Fulford, Jack Granatstein, David Bergeson. There's a whole crowd of them. You see them all the time in the media, and they're quick to sort of slap down anybody who speaks out against the U.S. They, you know, I think it's really an attempt to kind of squelch debate, and you know, they're quick to sort of label you anti-American. And so I just want to very clearly state that I don't consider myself anti-American. I do consider myself anti-American exceptionalism. And by that I mean, you know, I'm against the notion that America should be treated as an exception in the world, that America is somehow different than other nations, that, you know, that it's sort of a beacon of freedom. And as such, you know, it really has the right to operate under different rules than other nations. And this attitude, I think, very much pervades our elite. I would say, by contrast, that America is in fact just like any other nation. It's out there pursuing its own self-interest in the world. It's not some benign power trying to spread democracy. It's pursuing its own self-interest, and it's pursuing its own self-interest very aggressively often. So I would argue that America's entitled to the same rights and privileges as every other country in the world, but not to one single right more. It's just a nation like any other nations. But these neoconservative commentators seem to feel that the U.S. is entitled to a special set of rights. So, for instance, when the United States invades Iraq, or invades Afghanistan for that matter, which is contrary to international law, then the, you know, these commentators seem to think that's fine, and they encourage us to support that. Now, if, let's say, the Soviets had invaded Iraq, or the Soviets did invade Afghanistan, of course we were full of criticism for that, and the commentators just couldn't be critical enough. So you see, like, there's a separate set of rules. If America does something that we would normally consider bad, it's okay. So I would call those people American exceptionalists. They want to make an exception for America. Now, by the way, this is the same crowd that's always trying to remake Canada to be more like the U.S., you know, and they're always pushing for deeper integration with the U.S. And of course, one key area that they're always pushing in is deeper energy integration. That's one of the things that is very much on the agenda now. We've already integrated our energy considerably with the U.S. through NAFTA. We've already given up essentially given up our control over our ability to cut back on our exports of energy. Now they're pushing to extend that energy integration even further, so they will have even more control over our energy. In fact, the striking thing is, you know, this security and prosperity partnership that is currently being worked on to bring even more integration between Canada and the U.S. and Mexico. Again, energy security is the key thing. And they talk about North American energy security. By that, what they really mean is U.S. energy security, because we actually already have energy security. The problem is, by us focusing on making sure they have energy security, we are actually putting our own energy security in serious peril. I mean, in terms of our, we have pretty much a 10-year supply left of conventional oil and a 9-year supply of proven gas reserves, if we continue to use up oil and gas at the current rate. Well, that's not very much. Of course, we have the oil sands, but there's all kinds of problems, particularly environmental problems, of developing that. And yet, despite this clear concern that we should have about our own energy security, it's not an issue that is at all attracting the attention of our government. In fact, the National Energy Board recently replied to a request from the Parkland Institute to find out what studies are going on in terms of Canadian energy security, and the National Energy Board replied, well, we aren't doing any studies on Canadian energy security. The focus is all on North American energy security, which, as I say, means U.S. energy security. And I'm sure you heard about the the paper that just came out by Preston Manning and Mike Harris urging even deeper integration between the two countries and urging even stronger energy integration. You know, again, focus on U.S. energy security, no focus on Canadian energy security. So I would argue that our elite, and by that I would include our corporate, our financial elite, and also our political elite, our media elite, and our academic elite. This is sort of a broad group I'm describing here. But I would argue that these people essentially have demonstrated almost an indifference to Canada and a loyalty to America at the expense of Canada. I've talked about the way they sort of dismiss one as anti-American if you dare to criticize the United States. Even more extreme, I find that they will get angry if you even try and be positive about Canada. You know, if you dare to sort of try and define the values or the things that define Canada and make it a little bit different, this just really gets them going. You know, they find this outrageous. Robert Fulford, for instance, writing in the National Post, was derisive, absolutely derisive, and he described that collection of self-adoring notions we sometimes call Canadian values. So if you even try and define something you sort of like about this country, you just get slapped down. You know, you're being self-adoring.
This is CFRO 102.7 FM, Vancouver's listener-supported radio station. We're partway through an important speech by Canadian author Linda McQuaig about her new book, Holding the Bully's Coat, Canada and the U.S. Empire. Her previous books include Shooting the Hippo, It's the Crew, Dude, and The Banker's Wife. She is also a columnist for the Toronto Star newspaper. In today's speech from the Maritime Labour Centre in Vancouver, May 8, 2007, McQuaig examines how the so-called New Government of Canada, elected by a minority of Canadians, has moved the former peace-loving nation firmly into the camp of George W. Bush, the war on terror and militarism.
In fact, I would argue that the real problem in this country isn't a kind of anti-Americanism, but rather an anti-Canadianism on the part of, you know, key people in our elite. This neocon crowd has been very successful in promoting their agenda, and they're particularly reacting against the kind of Canada that emerged to some extent in the post-war years, a Canada that I would argue, valued notions like equality, inclusiveness, fairness, the rule of law, both at home and abroad. These are antithetical to the more unequal model the U.S. model that they're much more favorable towards. And so there's a tendency, this is what drives their argument, that we're kind of a washed-up power in the world because we're not a big sort of military power anymore. We're more focused on these other kinds of goals, or at least I would argue most Canadians are. But I would argue, ironically, that, you know, it's when Canada has asserted these kinds of goals in the world that it's actually, you know, taken on something of a leadership role in the world. In other words, it's been the very opposite of being a washed-up power. And I'd refer to the example of how Canada played a leadership role in developing the Anti-Landmines Treaty, which really is a significant achievement. And Canada really did play a significant role in that. Also the development of the International Criminal Court, and of course the development of international peacekeeping, which Lester Pearson back in 1956 played such a pivotal role in the Suez Crisis that he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. I mean, it's striking, isn't it, that, you know, last year was the 50th anniversary of the Suez Crisis and the very significant role Canada played in that in developing UN peacekeeping and winning the Nobel Peace Prize, and yet there was no celebration by the Harper government of this momentous, significant achievement. Compare that to the enormous celebrations recently for the 90th anniversary of Vimy. And you know, not to take away at all from the terrible sacrifice of the people who died at Vimy, but it was clear to me that what was going on there was not a desire to pay tribute to these people particularly, but the Harper government's desire to emphasize war and war making, and that this was the kind of Canada that they wanted to encourage. In fact, I find it striking, listening to all that coverage, how many times it was referred to that Canada became a nation at Vimy. You know, I mean, their idea of nation building is war and death. You know, if you talk about nation building like, you know, building public programs, building roads, building institutions that make this country work, they're not interested in that kind of thing. Give them body bags. That's the kind of nation building they want. So the tragically, though, I would argue that this new approach, this neoconservative approach, has been, of course, very successful. We've seen this in the area of neoliberal economic policies that they've imposed on us, and the cutbacks and social programs, the tax cuts, all this sort of things. And they're doing the same thing now very effectively from their point of view in foreign policy. I mean, we've abandoned peacekeeping. You know, having invented it, we've now abandoned UN peacekeeping. And we've greatly increased our military spending. We've done this with very little public debate on it. You know, our military spending went from $13 billion a year in 2005 to $21.5 billion a year by 2010. Now, that's an increase of $8.5 billion a year. That is $8.5 billion a year that could be spent on health care, education, all kinds of things that we need, poverty alleviation, housing, all kinds of things, native programs, things that we need in this country. Instead, that money is going to be diverted on a permanent basis to the military. And let me just say, you know, we've been so fed this notion that, well, we have to do this. We have to rebuild our decimated military. Well, let me just say that even before this escalation in military spending began, which it began under Paul Martin, it was accelerated under Harper, but even before that, Canada's military spending was already the seventh biggest in NATO. In other words, we were in the top one-third of NATO in terms of military spending. NATO is the biggest, most powerful military alliance in the world. There we were in the top one-third. Now, that would strike me as a lot of military spending. I mean, do we really want to push ourselves up higher and higher up that ladder? And by the way, in case you sort of have in your mind, you know, what the military lobby is always telling us that, you know, Canada's military spending is so low, we spend less than Greece or Turkey. Well, let me just explain that the way that they reach that particular statistic is by a little kind of sleight of hand, or at least by a false way of looking at the numbers. Here's what they do. They measure military spending as a percentage of GDP, rather than, in other words, in terms of the raw dollars, we're number 7. But in terms of proportion of GDP, countries like Greece and Turkey are much bigger military spenders than we are. Now, what does that tell you? All it tells you is that they're much poorer countries. We spend more, but they have a smaller overall economy. So therefore, they end up spending a higher proportion of their resources on the military. Now, think about that. You know, measuring spending on something as a proportion of GDP, sometimes that makes sense. Like, let's say you're looking at healthcare spending, as you know, that it's reasonable to measure countries around the world in terms of their healthcare spending as a proportion of their GDP, because healthcare is something that a nation presumably wants to and should spend a great deal of money on, but some nations can't afford to. So if a country has a big national income, then they can afford a very good healthcare system. But the military shouldn't be judged that way. In other words, as we get richer, we don't necessarily want to spend more on the military. Military spending should be determined by need, not by how rich we are. But they've twisted this around so that it looks as if Canada is a real laggard in military spending. And by the way, this is all part of a broader plan within our military, because there's been an enormous long-time frustration within our military about all this emphasis on peacekeeping. They really have always found that very annoying. I mean, they go into the military because they want to fight. And what they've long wanted to do is get rid of all this kind of peacekeeping emphasis and align themselves more with the U.S. military. I mean, the U.S. military is the big time, right? They're the boys with the big military toys. And in the U.S., you know, military people have enormous prestige. So our military has long been frustrated by this emphasis on peacekeeping, even though they've been more than happy to kind of keep that emphasis on peacekeeping front and center, because they know the Canadian public loves it. So, in fact, they've used that in the past to sort of keep military budgets, keep Canadian governments diverting money to the military. But when they actually determine how they're going to spend it, a tiny proportion of the military budget was in fact spent on peacekeeping, because that wasn't their priority. Now, since 9/11, they haven't even had to bother making the argument in favor of peacekeeping, because now they feel they can sort of come out of the closet and basically be pro-war. Now, of course, we're in the situation in Afghanistan now, and in fact, Gordon O'Connor, our defense minister, recently made the point that we're going to be there for another. Somebody was raising the question, do we really need all these tanks and military aircraft? And he said, well, these are long-term investments. We anticipate being in Afghanistan or places like that for the next 10 or 15 years. I mean, this is part of the Bush view of the sort of long-term, you know, on and on into the future war on terror. Let me just quickly say about Afghanistan, you know, it's always presented as a kind of war against evildoers, or a war to help women to reconstruct Afghanistan. The truth is, of course, it's really about none of that. In fact, a very important group inside Afghanistan is the Revolutionary Association of Women of Afghanistan, a very respected women's group. In fact, that was the group that took the video in the days of the Taliban of the public beheading and smuggled it out to CNN. And that was really what sort of caught world attention against the Taliban. Anyway, so that group has a great deal of prestige in the international community, was very listened to back in the Taliban days. Now that, you know, the Americans have put their new regime in, headed by Hamid Karzai. The revolutionary women of Afghanistan are extremely critical of this new regime, and the international press has no interest in that story at all. But let me just tell you, the Revolutionary Association of Women of Afghanistan have made the point that what's going on now essentially is that you have a conflict between, on one side, the Taliban, which they describe as being like wolves, and on the other side, this new group of warlords in power that they describe as being like rabid dogs. So we have a fight between the wolves and the rabid dogs, and we're intervening on the side of the rabid dogs. Now, I would, of course, a lot of people are now starting to realize that the war in Afghanistan is unwinnable, which I think is probably true. But I would argue that that isn't even the real issue. The real issue is not, is it winnable, or, as we often hear in these polls, is the price too high, are too many people dying? Those are all important questions. But I would argue that if the war was the right war, we would take those consequences. The real question is this a legitimate war? Is this a war that we should be fighting? And I would argue that it's not a legitimate war. It's very much part of Bush's war on terror, which is really an attempt to use 9/11 to justify a more assertive use of U.S. power in the world. We see this clearly in the case of Iraq. But the invasion of Afghanistan, it was also an illegal war. And this is something that really hasn't received very much attention. After 9/11, the U.S. decided to, their real interest, of course, was invading Iraq, but they decided to invade Afghanistan first, I think, really to sort of get Afghanistan out of the way so they could get on with their invasion of Iraq. But in doing so, they absolutely ignored international law. They just completely put it aside. There were things that they could have done under international law. And if anybody wants to raise this, I'd be happy to sort of go through the steps they could have taken, for instance, requesting the extradition of Osama bin Laden from Afghanistan, which the Taliban were actually making noises that they would have handed him over to an Arab country, or even to the U.S. if the U.S. would provide some evidence of guilt. Failing that, if the Taliban had not cooperated, the other thing they could have done was gone to the U.N. Security Council. There's provisions in the U.N. Charter for interventions in the interest of peace and international security. There could have been an international force constituted, but the U.S. had no interest in that. They could have actually I'm sure the UN Security Council would have gone along with such a request. But the U.S. didn't do that, and that's very significant, because they didn't want any restraints on their behavior. They wanted to be able to go into Afghanistan and do exactly what they wanted to do, which is, of course, what they did. And in the process, they killed perhaps 10, perhaps 20,000 people. We don't really know, because, of course, nobody even bothers to keep track of how many Afghans die. Now, of course, the U.S. has, installed a puppet government there, and there's now been elections, and they've been sanctioned by the United Nations. And so NATO is technically there with the support of the United Nations. But I think it's important to remember that this war, at its root, began as an illegal invasion, and the U.S. has continued to play a dominant role, and that, in fact, of course, plays a dominant role within NATO, and that from the beginning, it's been very much a corrupt kind of illegal and immoral venture, killing thousands of people. Don't forget, the whole Guantanamo Bay prison was set up basically to take the prisoners from Afghanistan and to be able to treat them outside the rules of international law. And I would argue all this is actually part of a larger venture on the part of the U.S. to create really what amounts to a clash of civilizations, you know, this notion of the West versus Islam. In fact, in working on the book, I attended a fascinating event at a Canadian Forces base in Toronto. This was an event of all military types. It was early on a Saturday morning. I somehow managed to get into this thing. But it was a lot of senior Canadian military people, military lobbyists, etc. And they brought this American general. His name was Thomas Metz, and he'd been a general in Iraq. He based in Fort Hood, Texas. They brought him up. And what was really striking about it, he was giving this whole lecture about the dangers of Islam. And he described how he had all these maps of the Islamic world. He made the point there's a billion Muslims in the world. And he said if even 1% of them are radical, which he said, you know, that would be a reasonable assumption, that's 10 million radical Muslims. And he was basically trying to get the Canadian military personnel all revved up about going to war against these 10 million Muslims. And, of course, the notion of war against millions of Muslims fits perfectly with the agenda, you know, of the U.S. military industrial complex, which, of course, needs enemies to keep justifying a military buildup. In fact, you know, they were lost, really, with the demise of the Soviet Union. And having this radical Muslim threat come along has been a godsend because, they can now justify war and they can now justify, all these military expenditures. In fact, it's fascinating that if you go back and look at some of the history, right after 9/11, there was a moderate leader in Iran, the president of Iran, by the name of Khatami, who was desperately trying to avoid this kind of clash of civilizations and was reaching out with an olive branch towards the Americans, saying, you know, we're with you in the fight against terror. The Americans, George Bush, would have none of it. The last thing George Bush wanted was any kind of friendship with Iran, who he quickly, you know, labeled part of the axis of evil, along with Iraq, the other oil-rich country that he wanted to attack, because they want enemies. You know, there has to be an enemy to justify the kind of buildup and to keep in place the enormous military infrastructure that was built up to fight the so-called Soviet menace. And in the book, I tell the story about how we've seen the rise of a mini military industrial complex here in Canada, really going back to the early days of the Mulroney government, and how this lobby, working with the Canadian military, has been very influential in moving us away from peacekeeping and more into war making. Of course, what's left out always of these stories about, you know, how the radical Muslims and how they're out to get us is any reference at all to the fact that the U.S. has been intervening in the Middle East for 60 years, and creating great resentment and hatred in that region. And that is, in fact, an important context for understanding terrorism. In fact, as Robert Pape, who's an expert on terrorism at probably the world's leading expert at the University of Chicago, he's studied suicide terrorism all over the world, and he says the one thing that defines every act of suicide terrorism is it's not religion or ethnicity or poverty or wealth. The one thing in every case has been a resentment against foreign occupation or against foreign troops in land that they perceive to be theirs and not to be, and that should not be something the foreign troops should be occupying. So, in other words, by intervening over there, I'm not in any way trying to condone or justify terrorism. I'm simply saying I think it's important to understand it and to see it as a response to foreign invasions, which really raises the question of what are we doing as a foreign army in Afghanistan. Of course, there we are, a Western alliance under NATO in, you know, in a part of the world, in an Islamic country, just fueling this notion of the clash of civilizations. I mean, don't you love the way Americans on CNN, you always hear them refer to foreign fighters in Iraq? And by that, they mean... I mean, you laugh, but nobody laughs when they say this on TV. I'm sitting there laughing every time they say it. But, you know, they'll talk about the foreign fighters, by which they mean people from Iran coming into Iraq or Saudi Arabia. They don't even notice that they're foreign, too, that Americans are foreign in Iraq, and we are foreign in Afghanistan. So all this raises the question, I mean, among other things, of course, by being there, we are greatly increasing Canada's chances of being victims of terror. I think that's just obvious. So you really wonder, why on earth are we there? You know, what is it all about? And I think the simple answer is just, and I can't think of another explanation that makes any sense, and we're there to please the Americans. I mean, we're there to curry favor with the Americans. And even the people who support being over there will kind of admit this when you sort of really get around to it. For instance, Jack Granatstein has argued, he says, our superpower neighbor, the nation to which 87% of our exports go, has been attacked. But somehow some Canadians haven't grasped that we're involved. Or Sean Maloney from the Royal Military College in Kingston, he wrote, the thinking in Ottawa may be that we will finally resolve the softwood lumber issue and keep our border open to trade by lessening America's burden in Afghanistan. Well, now that is really interesting, isn't it? So in other words, all of a sudden we're talking about our trade balance with the United States. We're talking about our softwood lumber industry. But we don't talk about that. Usually, when we talk about the sacrifices that our young people are making over in Afghanistan, I mean, when we have these military funerals, we don't make the point that these people died, you know, so we could have a good trade balance or we could have higher softwood lumber profits. But that's really essentially what it comes down to. And so I want to leave time for questions here. So I guess I just want to make the point that I don't think this is at all what ordinary Canadians want, this transformation that has happened. I think it's happened kind of without it really being in some ways noticed by Canadians. Now, the neocons always try and argue that, you know, Canada has fundamentally changed, that Canadians have changed. Rudyard Griffith, for instance, with the Dominion Institute, one of those neocon think tanks, he's argued that the election of the Conservatives of the Harper government is indicative of what he calls seismic shifts underway in the country. In fact, I think the election of the Conservatives really pretty clearly was just a function of the fact that the country felt the Liberals were simply so corrupt that they had to be punished and kicked out. It had nothing to do with any particular love of the Conservatives, certainly not a seismic shift. But Rudyard Griffiths goes on. He's so convinced of this seismic shift, he says, Canada's most cherished myths seem to be melting away. And he says, if we are not what we were, what now defines us as a nation? Put another way, what new national touchstones do we want to forge together to replace, say, universal health care or peacekeeping? And it describes a hunger for a new formulation of what it means to be a Canadian. Well, I don't think there's any hunger for a new formulation of what it means to be a Canadian, some neoconservative formulation of what it means to be a Canadian. In fact, my guess would be that Canadians have no interest in abandoning peacekeeping and certainly not universal health care, that what they really want is political leaders that will defend these institutions and that will support the traditions and the values of Canadians, that will adhere to the notion of Canada as a country that embraces equality, inclusiveness, and the rule of law. And I would argue that, in fact, I would take that, those kind of self-adoring, simple notions of what it means to be Canadian, you know, believing in equality, inclusiveness, and the rule of law, I'd take that any day over what our neoconservative elite has in mind for us, which is a helpmate's role, obligingly assisting the bully as he goes about trying to subdue the world. Thanks very much.
You've been listening to a speech by Canadian author Linda McQuaig about her new book, Holding the Bully's Coat, Canada and the U.S. Empire. Her previous books include Shooting the Hippo, It's the Crude Dude, and The Banker's Wife. She's a columnist for the Toronto Star newspaper. This speech was recorded by Thomas Hicks of the Necessary Voices Society. Find their website at necessaryvoices.org. Holding the Bully's Coat was previously broadcast by the Red Eye Collective on their Saturday morning show on CFRO. And this is CFRO 102.7 FM Co-op Radio in Vancouver. You're listening to the Tuesday Brown Bagger Show, where we focus on Canadian voices and especially top speeches from Vancouver as they become available. We have a small team of volunteers who go out and record speeches as well, which we share with other nonprofit college and community radio stations. Do you want to know more about Co-op Radio? If you want to get on the air or just support one of the few independent voices in the media, explore our website at www.coopradio.org. That's coopradio.org. We will get you the important information without commercial interruptions or interference only because people like you sign up for an annual membership. If you're not a member, please join to help keep the media open to new voices in a non-corporate atmosphere. You can join online or by telephoning the station at 604-684-8494. 684-8494. Become a member. Here are a few more clips and comments from Linda McQuaig from that online video.
Hillier's comment about Canada, the role of the Canadian Forces being able to kill people, reflects how a really dangerous kind of macho culture has taken hold here inside the Canadian Forces. In fact, you know, the real truth is Canadians have always loved Canada's role as a major force in international peacekeeping. As you know, of course, we practically invented UN peacekeeping with Lester Pearson in the 50s. And that has always been kind of inspiring to Canadians. We do have an importance in that our supporting the war on terror the way we have is extremely important to the Bush administration. They've lost support at home. They've lost support around the world. Having Canada, having Stephen Harper as an ally is extremely important to them because Canada has a certain credibility in the world. What Granitstein is really trying to do is trying to push us into the corner with the Americans and imply that we're just as vulnerable as they are. In fact, we're not, because they don't hate us over there. Now, of course, if we keep up what we're doing and become, as we have, such a loyal sidekick to the Americans, that could change. He'll say, therefore, any time they're at war, we're essentially at war, or we should be at war. Well, that is a very interesting notion. So in other words, the fact that we do so much trade with the U.S., he's saying, makes us essentially part of the U.S. or makes us so dependent on them that we have to go along with their wars. Well, to me, that is an argument against having so much trade with the United States. We have a chance to do things differently in the world, to move ourselves closer to the U.S. in order to curry favor with them is to fundamentally undermine, I would argue, the true Canadian character.
This is CFRO 102.7 FM Co-op Radio in Vancouver, and you're listening to The Brown Bagger Show. We'll go out with one of the sensations of net indie music, the top-rated song from Neil Young's anti-war hits chart. It's called Tin Can Call, and the band is called Tin Can Tele. That last word is T-E-L-E, like the beginning of telephone, and the band site is tincantele.com.
If you don't like his rules, he's gonna take his bat and ball home. Yeah, and it's going home. Yeah, he's going home. He wakes up in the morning, checks his messages, listens to his country on a tin can telephone. I can't hear a goddamn thing, 'cause my tin can won't ring. I got a warrant, I got a warrant on the world. Hi-ho, silver, and mom's away. I fill my tank for three and change, looking for someone to blame. The president, the New York Stock Exchange, who does no good, still the same. He's gotta fear the sun, 'cause he's strong enough to block it out with thunderclouds, lightning bolts and rain. And he's gotta load a gun, and our world will come undone. Bears his brother's arms. Hi-ho, silver, and bombs away. For peace, a history of a people come and gone. And when I grow up, I'm gonna be an astronaut. I'll discover a hidden secret on the moon. And I can hear a goddamn thing, 'cause my team can't fall on ring. I got a warning, I got a warning the world. His brother, bears his brother's arms. Hi-ho, silver, and bombs away. Hi-ho, silver.